yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the theme today is the global economy on the brink. Let's do a round robin of developments. And, of course, that will include the important news of this past week, which was another trade war with Mexico. Well, wait a minute. Didn't they just sign a treaty, a NAFTA 2.0, called the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement that's, you know, sitting in Congress, ready for ratification? Well, why have we got a threat of more tariffs on Mexico? 5% starting June 10th, going to 25%, 5% every month on Mexico. Okay, so what is that all about? Oh, and we want to talk about the new jobs numbers out today. All of a sudden, collapse job creation, even with official data and numbers. What's behind the global oil price deflation going on again? What's happening in the Eurozone economy? Japan, China, why are central banks globally, everywhere, rushing to cut rates? What's going on? Well, what's going on is we are slouching towards a global recession, and including a slowdown significant here in the U.S. You know, what do we got today? We get these job numbers come out today that showed only 75,000 jobs created, according to the current employment survey, the factory survey, the large corporation job survey. You know, there's two surveys, as we've talked about before. One's called the household survey that they get the unemployment rate from. That's based on a phone survey of 60,000 people a month. And then we have the CES survey, which is about 400,000, 450,000 out of the 9 million companies, 10 million companies in the U.S. You know, the factory survey is the one that you hear about jobs, number of jobs creation. The unemployment rate is from the phone survey. And we've talked about the problems with having those two different kinds of surveys and the problems of those surveys still looking at the past. In other words, based upon conditions when labor markets have not changed dramatically in the United States, because of contingent labor and gig and sharing economy and all the other changes that have been occurring. I don't want to get into that. We talked about that in previous shows. Go back and listen to some of the shows here I've done earlier this year and about why job statistics aren't accurate. But let's just go with their statistics today, which show the employment situation report. That's what it's called. Summarizes, it's an umbrella report, summarizes the two surveys. Actually, one's not a survey. In any event, it shows 75,000 jobs only created. Well, you know, there are between 125,000, 150,000 new entrants into the labor market every month. Yes. 100 to 150,000. Depends, you know, they've been lowering that number. It used to be 150,000 new entrants. Now they're saying, oh, lots of people are retiring, so it's only 125. Well, even if it's 125 new people coming into the labor market for the first time looking for work, we've only created 75,000 jobs. Whoa, that's a big contraction from what's been happening. In other words, jobs are a lagging indicator, they call it, of the economy, and that lag is really lagging. Now, it's catching up with the rest of the slowdown that's beginning to appear here and there, a kind of employment mosaic in the U.S. economy. 75,000 jobs, that's all. Well, I knew this was coming. because earlier in the week, a private forecasting company called ADP, which has its own database, which kind of parallels the CES establishment database, CES Current Establishment Survey, it's called, was also showing a significant decline in jobs last month in May. Yeah, they reported earlier this week only 27,000. Now, that survey, ADP, that private survey, is not as accurate as in some ways, but it shows the momentum and the direction. And it's interesting, you know, ADP served job surveys in the past months when they've come out, they've had a significant impact on the stock market because it's a reflection of the real economy. But this time, they passed it up. I mean, there was no response pretty much by the stock market. In fact, the stock market was recovering for much of this week from last week's collapse. So interesting, you know. And in fact, when the numbers came out today, the stock market rose. You know, a number of 75,000 jobs in the past would have caused the stock market to correct, and investors would have said, "Gee, the U.S. economy is slowing." Well, why did it rise today? And in fact, been rising even after the ADP numbers on Wednesday. Well, it's because investors know the Fed is about to lower interest rates, and that has a bigger impact on financial markets than the concern about jobs, which simply means that stocks are more sensitive to financial moves than it is to the real economy anymore. It's got distorted significantly in the last two decades. That's why central bank Fed policy is all screwed up. Has very little effect on the real economy anymore, but a big effect on the stock markets, you see. I've been saying that for some time. One of the themes in my 2017 book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. So, you know, is this really bad job number here a flashing yellow or a flashing red light on the U.S. economy? You know, this is 1 month. You can say, oh, well, 1 month, that doesn't mean very much. Well, if you look at since the beginning of the year, the trend has been downward in job creation. The last three-month average, in other words, March, April, May, 151,000. And they've revised down the March numbers from 189 to 153, and April from 263 to 224,000. So with the 75,000, we get a three-month average of 151. Well, that's kind of an economy that's just about marking time in terms of job creation, but the trend for the last 3 months is clearly down. Well, we'll see next month whether we get a return to above 100,000 jobs created or whether it keeps hovering below. I think it's going to sink in to investors that, the real economy, even a lagging indicator like jobs, is really slowing. And that brings me back to a previous analysis I did on this show, on first quarter GDP, which came in at 3.1%. Well, that's a pretty good growth rate. Well, as I explained, it was two-thirds driven by trade, meaning businesses investing in inventory buildup to get ahead of the tariffs, and net exports being positive and rising simply because imports due to tariffs were falling. If you back out those two factors, what you get is a real GDP of barely 1.5%. And that's what the banks, by the way, were forecasting for first quarter GDP before it became clear that this trade effect was boosting temporarily, because now that is fading. The trade effect is fading. And if you looked at first quarter GDP, investment was only 2.7%. growth in real investment, you know, plant and equipment and so forth, compared with the previous year, first quarter of 20%. So it was declining rapidly. And very weak consumption numbers, 1.2% for consumption. All right, I think we're going to see continued weak investment and consumption in the second quarter here, and we're going to see GDP closer to 1.5% than 3%. And that's going to really put some fire under the Fed to lower interest rates even further. Those interest rates cuts are coming, and we'll talk about that some more. But once again, the effect will be mostly on stocks. It won't be on the real economy. I am not a big believer that monetary policy and cutting the cost of credit is simply going to have an effect on the real economy. I think, as I argued in my book, that effect is significantly declined when we are in an economy that is financialized. More and more investment is going to financial asset markets instead of real investment. And simply lowering the cost of money does not drive up real investment. There are other factors involved that determine the cost of money. I mean, and the investment. So all this focus on monetary policy is focusing on a policy option that has less and less effect over time as the capitalist economy is restructured into a more financial form than a real form. Okay, so that's my prediction. We'll see what happens in the second quarter of GDP, but it's going to be significantly lower. And I think we're going to see before the end of June, the Fed could even indicate and its intent to lower interest rates. It's already indicated its intent this past week, you see. That's why the stock market kind of recovered this week, because the Fed, which stopped raising rates in January to stop the bleeding and the collapse of financial markets, stock markets in the fourth quarter last year, you know, as soon as the Fed said it stopped raising rates, then the financial markets partially recovered, about two-thirds, but now they're going to lose that two-thirds through the rest of the year, I believe. But, you know, the Fed action halted the collapse of the stock markets. And then the Fed developed the policy, what it called patience, meaning, we're not going to raise rates, we're not going to lower rates yet, blah, blah. Well, this past week, the Fed gave a nice signal that, okay, we're going to lower rates. And that's what caused the stock market to recover this week. You see, it's very, very focused. The markets are very focused on Fed policy. But at the same time, the contradiction is lowering interest rates, the cost of credit, does not necessarily result very much anymore in real investment. It goes into financial markets. Okay. That's why monetary policy is not all that effective anymore. And, you know, we have this interesting development called modern money theory, which I'm going to talk about in a more general way in a future show here, which is kind of quantitative easing turned on its head. But it's a monetary approach. And monetary policy, whether it's to stimulate the real economy or to stimulate financial markets, the real economy is not that much stimulated anymore from it. So I'm a little dubious about a monetary solution, even called MMT, to get the economy going again. All right, so I don't want to jump too much into MMT. We'll do that in more detail in a subsequent show soon. All right, so, the first big topic was today's jobs number, 75,000. No more lagging, catching up to the rest of the economy that is slowing down. I mean, manufacturing is stagnant, not just in the U.S., but globally, and some estimates are we're in a manufacturing global recession already. And in other countries, it's far more important, manufacturing and manufacturing exports. All right, so the other thing about job numbers, let me just finish with this, is that if you look under the covers in a little more depth, unemployment, right, in the last 5 weeks has been increasing. Unemployment has been increasing. 243,000 increase in workers who are unemployed in less than 5 weeks. In other words, 243,000 more unemployed just in the last month. All right, so of course there are hired people that offsets that number as well, but the fact is that a big increase in the number being laid off just in the last 5 weeks, which is, part of this bigger labor market picture, which includes this very highly visible number of 75,000 net jobs created only. All right, so let's move on. Let's talk about Mexico. Mexican tariffs, right? Trump surprised the world here by announcing he's imposing tariffs on Mexico earlier in the week. That was the other big weekly news. 5% starting on Monday, June 10th, and then 5% every month thereafter as necessary, up to 25%. If Mexico does not do something about the immigration from Central America coming through Mexico, coming to the U.S. border, right? So this is really about immigration. This is using tariffs as a tool not to get economic or trade reform. That's already, in being baked in the USMCA deal and NAFTA 2.0 before Congress here. Okay, so he's using tariffs for immigration. In other words, using tariffs as a bludgeon here to get Mexico to try to stop more of this exodus from Central America. Okay, well, Mexico's been doing a lot. They've sent back 85,000 people here coming from, Honduras, Salvador, and Guatemala. 85,000 have been intercepted and sent back, and tens of thousands more have been resettled in Mexico. And this is a big cost to Mexico, of course, as its economy now slips into recession first quarter of this year. Okay, so it's not as if Mexico has been doing nothing, right? But Trump slaps these really tough tariffs on Mexico as well. The question is, to what do these tariffs apply? Is it just goods manufactured, made in Mexico and shipped across the border? Is it goods that transit from elsewhere in the world through Mexico? Is it goods that go back and forth several times from the U.S., Southwest, elsewhere, into Mexico, and other semi-finished goods, come back to the U.S. and get finished some more, go back to Mexico, along the border there, U.S. companies, and get further? Do they pay 5%, 25% every time it crosses the border? Well, isn't that clear to me? I'm sure that they're defining that. They're negotiating right now. But in other words, 5% can really be more than 5% in terms of finished goods. All right, but the important thing to understand about what's going on with these tariffs is it's about Trump's election 2020. Everything this guy does from this point on, and much of it before, is all about himself getting re-election in 2020. He doesn't really give a damn for the rest of the country here. He's only thinking about his 35% base and satisfying them with his America First economic nationalism. Every time he beats up on some foreign government, or foreign corporation, or foreign workers, he appeals to that base. That nationalist base, which thinks that all our problems are due to foreigners. Yeah, that's what Herbert Hoover kept talking about. You know, it was all the foreigners that caused the Depression back in the 1930s. If only those Europeans would get their act straight, we wouldn't have a Depression. That was Herbert's line. And, you know, it's kind of Trump's line here now. And, of course, stopping the immigration or looking tough on the immigrants and tough on Mexico. And these immigrants aren't from Mexico, by the way, but Mexico paying the price here. You know, he's appealing, he's looking tough to his base. Ah, but there's something else I really think that's behind this. And we saw it emerge with the U.S.-China trade war. Right? Trump imposed, you know, $250 billion 25% tariffs on Chinese imports into the United States. And he liked the fact that that generated a good deal of tariff revenue for himself. You know, he was bragging time and again about, oh, you know, tariffs are great. Look at all the revenue we got just from, you know, tariffing half of the Chinese imports. And I'm going to put another $300 billion tariffs on all Chinese imports. This is generating a lot of tariff revenue for us. Well, I think he's got the same objective here with Mexico. I think no matter what, tariffs are going to remain. No matter what Mexico does to stopping immigration, I think Trump likes the fact that there are some tariffs that will produce revenue. Now, why is he doing that? Because he believes the revenue will pay for his wall. He can't get the money from Congress. This is a separate way for him to raise revenue to pay for his wall, to make, quote, Mexico pay for the wall. This is the promise he made to his base, and he's going to really shout that to the hills here. Yes, this is about election. Not just stopping, slowing immigration, looking tough, but raising money to build his wall that he can go next year in election year and say, see what I did? I promised I would be tough on these foreigners, and I promised to build the wall, and now I got the money, and I'm building the wall. Yeah, 2020 election. That's what this is about, right? Now, is Mexico really going to pay for that wall with the tariffs? No, you're going to pay for the wall with the tariffs. You know, you're going to pay for it with lost jobs because the tariffs are going to cause eventually, not right away, but eventually companies to shut down in Mexico. And because they won't get the parts, the supply chains will be disrupted. Companies in the U.S. are going to have to cut back production. That means this is going to cause a loss of jobs in the U.S. But more importantly, it's going to cause inflation. The American consumer is going to pay for this wall. He's going to say Mexico's paying for it, but no, you're paying for it. Estimates are it's going to add 1 to 1.35 percentage points to the consumer price index. Yeah, which is already, they say, at what, 1.5? So 3%. But, you know, that's an average spread over millions of different products. That's an average. Or at least hundreds or thousands of products in the consumer price index. So certain products can go up quite a bit. Representatives from the auto industry have been on TV, and they've said that, these tariffs will result in an increase in auto prices of at least $5,000 per auto, maybe even more. Yeah. So you're going to pay for it, middle America, through higher costs of various kinds. You're going to pay for the Mexican tariffs, and they're going to remain, some of them, maybe not the full 5%, but some are going to remain just enough for him probably to raise $10 billion in order to pay for his wall. Yeah, that's what's behind this. Everything this guy does at this point is about his reelection, and he doesn't care how much blood he leaves on the ground, what kind of mess he makes. It's all about getting himself reelected. Okay, moving on in our review. Global oil prices are falling once again. I think they've declined maybe 20% already. You know, last year they collapsed 40%. It was a big crisis last year as stock markets collapsed and other markets collapsed. You see, all these financial assets are connected, and oil is a financial asset. It's not just a commodity. No, oil futures contracts are a financial asset. And that's why they fluctuate so much. Speculators get in and drive it up, drive it down. Long run, supply and demand play a role. But, you know, week to week, day to day, even month to month, the fluctuations are because of oil speculation and oil futures. Well, those prices are going down again, right? I predicted they would last year. You know, go back and listen to one of the shows, or certainly, read the article I wrote on oil price deflation on my blog, jackrasmus.com. I think it was late last year, where I predicted the attempts by Russia and Saudi Arabia to cut production in order to get the price back up would be short-lived. Why? Because, one, Russia, if its economy slowed, which I said it would, has to pump more oil even at a lower price in order to generate government revenue, budget revenue, in order to keep its economy and spending going as the recession slowed. So Russia would break ranks, I predicted. As would possibly some of the members of OPEC. And it's just this deal, this short-term deal with Russia and Saudis that was able to get the thing back up a little bit. And, of course, the U.S. going after Iran, trying to stop Iran oil and Venezuela, that is all designed as well to create global oil shortages in the short run to raise prices. You got to understand that that's at least part of the U.S. attack on Iran and Venezuela, you know, to prevent them from selling their oil, to reduce the supply of oil, drive up the price of oil, right? But those two don't produce that much. You know, the big players in oil supply are three. It's Saudi Arabia and it's buddies there in the UAE, but mostly Saudi Arabia, Russia, and the United States. In fact, the U.S. is the biggest producer and seller of oil since the shale revolution. And the U.S. is pumping more and more oil. As I said last year, they will increase their amount of oil per day, million barrels per day, from what was about 11 to 12 million barrels per day by the middle of this year, which of course is true. I think it's at 12.5 million barrels per day. So as the Russians and the Saudis tried to cut their supply, the U.S. is stepping in, the shale producers stepping in and increasing theirs. All right. So we get an increasing supply, which drives down the price. Well, why are the U.S. shale producers doing that? Because I think 2/3 of the drillers have financed their expansion through junk bonds, energy junk bonds. Energy junk bonds are now over half, I think, of the total U.S. Junk bonds being issued. Junk bonds are high interest rate bonds that only shaky companies can get, or what shaky companies get. They have to pay a higher interest rate to get it because they are not as safe a company in the long run. So the banks charge them a higher rate. That's why they call them junk bonds. Well, the U.S. shale producers are primarily junk bond financers. And that means they got to pay the principal and interest, high interest, on those junk bonds. And they're racing to do that by pumping more and more oil. You see, that's a driver, a big driver for the collapse of global oil prices. And that's going on right now, right? So shale producers continuing, as I forecast, to produce even more oil. And Russia and Saudi Arabia not being able to check that. And Russia now, as its economy slows, probably will break off from the agreement and pump more oil because it must as well. Well, you know, the big oil producers just got together here, and the Saudi oil minister, Faleh, or whatever his name was, said, oh, well, you know, we're almost in agreement with the Russians. Almost was the phrase. No. Right? We're going to see more deflation in oil prices. You know, the West Texas, what they call NYMEX, oil prices is about $50 now, I think. 50-something. I think it'll go to 40. And the Brent, in other words, the European high-quality oil, which is at about 60, will probably go to 50 at some time during the 2019 economy. Well, you know, that's going to feed business confidence, believing that, dropping oil prices must mean demand for oil by industry is declining, and that must be that the economies are slowing, and that will affect investment. All right, since we're talking about the economies, let's talk about the Eurozone, where manufacturing is stagnant now. And it just came out here yesterday that Germany, which is the engine of Europe, the Eurozone, I think like 40% of that economy there is German economy. German industrial production just had its worst month in 4 years. Yes, worst month. The German engine is sputtering significantly, and of course the Eurozone will quickly follow. And it is already, you know, Italy's in recession, some of these other countries are very close, France is drifting, deflation or disinflation, prices slowing, approaching deflation occurring, right? The 10-year government bond in Germany is now negative. In other words, if you want to buy government bonds, you're not going to get any interest. You're going to have to pay interest to buy the bond. It's crossed the negative territory. Throughout Europe, interest rates, government bond rates are increasingly negative. Some figure I saw, I just wrote about not long ago, was amazing, and that is there's over $10 trillion in negative rate government bonds right now in Europe. And that has doubled in just the last 18 months. Yeah, $10 trillion negative interest rates, right? The whole idea was with negative rates, well, force these companies, these banks rather, to lend. You know, if banks have to pay to hold government bonds, right? Well, instead of paying and buying government bonds, what they'll do, the theory says, is that they will lend to business, and that will stimulate the Eurozone economy. Well, bank lending, ever since QE has been instituted in the $3 trillion subsidy here for the banks, QE, quantitative easing, by the ECB, European Central Bank, right? Bank lending has declined. Slow. What's happening is the government is buying all these bonds, and whoever is selling them, corporate bonds I'm talking about too. You know, it's not buying just government bonds, it's buying corporate bonds, the ECB. Well, you know, this money from the sale of these bonds, corporate bonds, just flows right out of Europe to the U.S. or to other economies, and therefore Europe really can't get going. Europe has not recovered from the Great Recession. You see, the 2008-09 recession, and then Europe had a double dip recession in 2011-13, and then in 2015-16, it stagnated, almost fell into recession again. It's been a stop-go, no real recovery since the Great Recession. Well, I predicted that back in my 2010 book called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, where what we have now is this kind of stop-go recovery in the weakest links of the global economy. And that's what I called an epic recession, where you had a big financial crash like 2008-09, and you never really get true recovery, especially if you rely on monetary policy, which has been the case, and austerity on the fiscal side, which has been the case. And Europe has been a stop-go, stop-go. In other words, short, shallow recoveries followed quickly by declines, subsequent recessions or stagnation periods. Well, Europe is about to fall into its third, maybe fourth, at least stagnation, maybe third recession since 2008, fourth stagnation. Epic recession, right? And you see it reflected in massive non-performing bank loans in Europe, trillions of dollars of NPLs, non-performing loans. Non-performing meaning the loans that were made by banks to non-bank companies, the latter simply aren't paying the principal and interest. They're not paying it back. They're non-performing. In other words, no payback, which shows the non-financial economy is in bad shape in Europe, not just the banks. And, of course, the banks are in trouble in Europe. It's a real weak link in the global banking capitalist system. You see it with Deutsche Bank and Italian banks and other banks in France, Credit Agricole, Barclays, and still in the UK. The bank, Commerce Bank in Germany, Raiffeisen Bank in Austria, they're all in trouble. You see, and we haven't even slipped into the next recession and they're already in trouble. Right? And that's why the ECB has already begun to bail them out. We're not even in a bank crisis and they're already bailing them out with this program they call the long-term refinancing option, LTRO. Well, I'm not going to get into technicality. You can read some of my publications with the European Financial Review articles on all that. Okay, so Eurozone economy is in deep trouble. $10 trillion in negative rates, all right, on bonds, corporate bonds, government bonds. Easily maybe $3 trillion in non-performing bank loans, right? A new bailout with the LTRO occurring already. And the UK economy hasn't even Brexited yet. Is that a verb, Brexited? I don't know. Sounds like it. They're slipping into a recession now as well, and we haven't even had the effects of Brexit, which will start at the end of the year. So it's in deep doo-doo. Europe's in deep doo-doo, right? And now the Federal Reserve, U.S. Central Bank, is lowering its rates, and that means that the European Central Bank and the Bank of England have to lower their interest rates if the U.S. does, because if they don't lower their interest rates to keep them below the U.S., lowering in a Europe case means more negative, right? That's going to have an impact on their exports. And Europe, especially Germany, is far more dependent on exports than even is the United States. So they have to lower even further. Or return to some QE policy. You know, they've already spent $3 trillion on QE, free money to the banks. So what are they going to do next? They bought up most of the bonds. Well, they can start buying stocks, just like the Japanese have done and the Bank of Japan has done. It's propped up those financial markets, the BOJ, ever since. By buying exchange-traded stock funds and other commercial property funds. In other words, stock markets. Keep the stock markets going by direct subsidization, the government, the central bank, buying stocks. The biggest buyer of stocks is the Japanese government, right? That's the harbinger of things to come where monetary policy and central bank policy has to go. In other words, to keep the financial markets of the global capitalist system from collapsing again, as in 2008-09, they're becoming the biggest purchaser of those financial markets, securities, whether they're stocks or corporate bonds. The central banks are becoming more and more a vehicle of subsidization of capital and capital incomes. More and more. They're not, and interest policy is not so much anymore about stabilizing the economy. It's all about subsidizing capital and capital incomes. And we see, of course, on the fiscal side, tax cuts for corporations, investors, and the wealthy doing the same thing. This capitalist state in the 21st century is playing a greater and greater role of subsidizing capital incomes and capitalist investors and capitalist class like never before. And of course, that means fiscal monetary policy is not that effective anymore as a stabilization tool. It's a subsidization tool more and more. Well, you know, mainstream economic theory doesn't acknowledge this and realize this. Okay, so EU problems, Brexit is coming, trade conflict with the U.S. around the corner on autos, right? Exports to emerging markets, which are very important for the EU, are declining as those economies slip into recessions as well. Deflation is approaching once again. QE and free money does not result in bank lending. Europe is the sick link, the sick man, the weak link of the global capitalist economy right now. Okay. All right. So central banks around the world are rushing to lower interest rates. Yes. This is a reflection, finally, that the slowing global economy is something very real. I mean, you know, weekly the IMF and World Bank issue warnings about this and reduce their forecast repeatedly. And, of course, now the central banks are acknowledging this and lowering interest rates. As I said, the Fed is about to indicate a reduction of interest rates. That's why the stock market's booming again this week, temporarily. Well, you know, everyone knows that the European Central Bank has to lower as well, and the BOE, Bank of England, has to lower as well. But already other countries' central banks have begun lowering their rates. India has lowered its rates several times. It's at a level of 2010 now. Australia, which hasn't lowered rates for decades, I think, is now lowering its rates. Malaysia, Philippines, New Zealand, Mexico, right? That's now approaching recession. And, of course, we have a problem in Brazil and Argentina. Lowering interest rates will cause their currency to deflate even more. And they have a problem with deflation in their currency. But they're between a rock and a hard place. You know, they have to lower rates because everyone else is, or their exports will be more expensive. But if they lower their interest rates, that will cause capital flight out of their countries. That will slow their economies even more. So Latin America's in trouble, that's for sure. South Africa is in recession once again. All these commodity-producing countries are in recessions. The recession will get worse for the oil-producing countries as that price declines, right? But we have a central banks lowering their rates, right, being forced to do so because long-term interest rates are coming down fast. Bond rates are long-term, 10-year, 30-year, 5-year, because the global economy is slowing, which is forcing central banks to reduce short-term interest rates. You see, central banks only have influence over short-term rates, and they're behind the curve being forced to lower their interest rates, you know, as the long-term rates start to squeezing the short-term rates down. That's called the yield curve. Right? We've talked about that. Right? So we got a long-term bond rate bust going on, and as bond rates decline, the price of bonds rise. So if the price of bonds, the return on bonds is rising, well, you better get your money out of stocks and so on and elsewhere and put it in bonds and make some money in bonds. Well, that shift is going on now, right? So we had a temporary halt to the stock crash of last fourth quarter of last year by the Fed saying it wasn't going to raise rates anymore in January, and that caused a 3 or 4 month stabilization and partial recovery stock markets, right? And now, as the global economy slows even more, and it looks like the trade war with China is reverberating globally, slowing in China and elsewhere, Europe, the convergence of this is causing the Fed to give signals it's going to start cutting rates too. Okay. Well, what about Japan and China? What's the situation there? Well, we've got negative interest rates in China, I mean in Japan rather, and we got exports contracting or slowing. And in the first quarter, business investment and consumption, the real economy, already was declining. So we're going to see a recession in Japan here this quarter or next as well. The yen is rising as the dollar declines, and that's going to have an effect on monetary policy in Japan. They're going to have to lower rates to keep the yen from rising, because if the yen rises, Japanese exports decline, which they already are, right? So what are you going to do in Japan? They're already deeply in negative rates, like Europe, and probably have even trillions of non-performing loans, bank loans, in Japan as well, right? More negative rates, is that coming? Well, you know, they're buying up bonds, I mean, buying up stocks. You know, that's the future for central banking, the Bank of Japan. QE, next QE is buy up stocks, not just buy up corporate bonds, you see. Or engage in what's called bail-ins. They want to bail out the banks, right? When they have a big problem, next round, well, they're already planning, U.S. included, U.K. and others, planning to, if you've got money in the bank, depositors, well, if your bank's in trouble, then they will force convert your cash, your money in the bank, into buying bank stocks. You'll have the value of your deposits, but it'll be in the form of near worthless bank stocks. That's called bail-ins. In other words, make the depositors bail out the banks. That's the next thing coming, next crisis, bail-ins. And then, you know, they may start with only wealthy folks with $250,000 or more. But if that doesn't work, they'll just lower that to $100,000 or whatever they need to bail out the banks next time. And more QE, of course. So Japan is on the cusp or already in a recession. Europe is certainly on the cusp and in some places already in a recession. The U.S. economy is slowing very clearly here. China, the other big player, right? Well, China's economic growth has been slowing as well. You got official numbers, and then there's the real numbers, which are something less than the official numbers. But manufacturing is contracting. Exports are slowing dramatically in China. Stock market is declining. Stock markets in China are declining fast. We have a lot of non-performing loans, non-financial loans in China as well. We don't know exactly how many, but it's quite possible that there's more than $5 trillion in NPLs in China. And that means when you have another crisis, somebody is going to have to bail out those NPL non-financial corporations or let them default. If they default, then the losses to the banks grow because they hold the defaulted securities. And then you got to bail out the banks. You see, either bail out the non-financial companies first or you bail out the banks later. And already we're seeing problems with bad debt, corporate bad debt in China beginning to appear. Just this past week, the Baoshang Bank defaulted, meaning had to be bailed out by the government. And they're, you know, it's kind of a private bank, mid-sized private bank. China banking system is a mix of government banks at the top and a lot of private banks and shadow banks below it. This middle tier of private banks, estimates are it is about $650 billion and about 20 of these banks that may default. Well, the problem in, China can handle that, probably $650 billion, but what happens to confidence? Confidence, business investing confidence, not just in China, but globally. China slowing down significantly is what is worrying the IMF and to some extent the World Bank and others, because it's a big part of the global economy. And as it slows, the whole global economy slows. And of course, the trade war with the U.S. is having an impact on that. And Trump is betting that China will capitulate as things get worse, as its stock markets continue to decline and as its exports slow and manufacturing contracts and so forth. They're betting that the Chinese will capitulate, as I've said, on the key demand that the U.S. hardliners and neocons want, which is technology. See, they want China to capitulate on next generation technology because it's got military implications, you see, in industries of the future. That's what the trade war with China is all about. It's really the crux of the disagreement has to do with technology, next generation technologies, 5G, which is Huawei corporation there in China, and cybersecurity and artificial intelligence. So, the trade war is having an effect on China. It's also having an effect on the U.S. as well, you see, maybe even faster on China, but on the U.S., no doubt. Trump thinks that he can hold out for the 2020 election, and if the economy slows down, which it will between now and then, blame China, blame Mexico. Blame all the foreigners, right, for the problem. It's not our problem. Yeah, Herbert Hoover all over again. The foreign enemy, you see. You keep that 35% U.S. heartland base all pumped up with that. And, maybe soybean farmers in the process are going to have some heartburn here. But, they, we'll redirect some of this money we have Trump has provide bailouts for the farmers, which he's already done. $12 billion last year, $16 billion just announced. Next year, if we're in a recession, it'll be more than $20 billion. So $50 billion just for the farmers, which is mostly agribusiness, by the way, right? We'll bail them out, right? Well, who else is he going to bail out? Well, that's why he needs to raise tariff revenues to help on the bailout. But although he'll get a lot of help from Congress on bailing out the farmers, you see, because of their constituencies in the red states. He may have to put up some of his own money. Well, that's another reason why Trump is engaging and slouching towards a constitutional crisis with Congress, particularly the House of Representatives, right? Everything he's doing is bypassing the House. Under the Constitution, the House has the responsibility for raising funds, right? They have the power of the purse. And they're not willing to go along with Trump building his wall and so forth. So Trump is governing by national emergency and bypassing the House and raising money in other ways. And I think the tariffs are one of the ways he raises money to finance his programs and what he wants to do, bypassing the House. Yeah, when the House of Representatives of Congress passes a piece of legislation, it earmarks what it's got to be spent on. Then it's then it passes appropriations bill that say, okay, this money has to be spent only on this or that, right? Well, Trump wants to take that money and spend it on what he wants, and he's using national emergency as the excuse to do what he wants on trade, to do what he wants on bypassing Congress and developing his own financial source of revenue for his own programs. Well, that's a constitutional crisis. That's a violation of the Constitution. We're going to see more of that. And we're already seeing a lot of that, aren't we? on purely political side, where Trump is saying to everybody in the executive branch, you can't go and speak to Congress. You can't speak to the House. You can't speak to these committees because they're trying to find out what I'm doing and what I did, you know, with Russia and Russiagate and whatever, right? I don't want any of you talking to them, right? Well, he's stonewalling Congress. He's refusing to respond to subpoenas by Congress, which is also a constitutional defined right of Congress. Go read Article 1 of the Constitution, right? The House has the responsibility for investigations. This is part of checks and balances. Well, you know, when you want to govern by yourself without the legislative branch, right? The hell with checks and balances. And that's what's going on, right? We are drifting towards a constitutional crisis, and Trump is doing it because he doesn't care what that means and the consequences of all that. He just wants to get elected in 2020. He can do whatever he has to do. And the Democrats are falling for it. You see, Democratic leadership is being outmaneuvered left and right every step by Trump. Unfortunate. Unfortunate. And they don't have the backbone to take him on. You know, I talked about this last week about the Mueller report. I'm not going to go in detail again, but very clearly, you know, Pelosi, Schumer don't want impeachment, even though polls increasingly show that the members in the base of the Democratic Party wants impeachment. They want it. But Pelosi says, oh, if we do that, you know, we may make it easy for him to win, you know. Well, that's all because the Democratic strategy is targeting moderate Republicans instead of targeting the base of half of the people in this country that don't vote because they don't see anything in their interest being proposed, right? Instead of mobilizing them and turning them out to win election, they're fighting for the suburbanites with the Republicans, you know, in those swing states, right? And that means that they, you know, their strategy is incorrect. And that's why they'll lose in 2020 if they don't change, right? You may have picked up a few House seats in the last 2018 election with that strategy. And it was targeting suburbia and middle-class voters and independent voters and, you know, veterans and so forth, right? You swung a few House seats, but they're so terrified that if they go after Trump impeachment, they'll lose those House seats. But they're not looking at the effect of impeachment proceedings, what it would produce, perhaps, in mobilizing other people left of center. That's why their strategy is a failed strategy, I believe. And, of course, this past week, we see this even more because what happened? You know, the whole idea here with the Democrat strategy was let's subpoena these people. Well, Trump would say, nope, you can't subpoena them. You know, if you initiated impeachment proceedings, then the subpoenas would have to be honored. Well, this Democratic leadership is saying, well, let's go to the courts. You know, that's just delay and deny strategy. Okay, that's it for today. Lots of news. Next week, we'll see what happens with Mexico and the tariffs.